individuals because they don't exist within their world.
This year, 2026, the city of Vancouver raised property taxes by zero. They kept property taxes at the same rate as last year. The city and the park board have been exponentially raising user fees. So this is another characteristic of a corporate methodology of efficiency. So it's favoring the wealthy property owners, and you have to be pretty wealthy to own property in Vancouver, by the way. So you don't have to pay anywhere property taxes, but people who can't afford homes, who are less well off or who are poor, low income, now they're getting priced out of public services. You raise the example of the Kits pool. So this is another example of the sort of the corporatocracy, the corporatism, the privatization. So the Vancouver Park Board in 2024, they introduced a what they call the Think Big Revenue Strategy. And so what is that? So I just want to read a couple excerpts from the PowerPoint presentation that was presented at the meeting where the Park Board approved this. It was devised by the city bureaucrats and presented to the seven commissioners, and seven commissioners approved it. Think Big includes nine major initiatives. And they say it's been delivering so far on its key objectives: enhance the vibrancy of public spaces and generate non-property tax revenue. So they're claiming that they've enhanced the vibrancy of public spaces. And I think what they mean by that is more commercialization. It's more vibrant because now there's more like private events going on and so on. And generate non-property tax revenue. So that tells you right there that the purpose is to, the point is to generate revenue, not through property taxes, but through user fees or by leasing out public spaces to private businesses and private activities and events. So they talk about here the one, two, three, four, five, the nine initiatives that are underway, the Think Big initiatives. So what they are sponsorship and naming rights, optimized parking revenue, street furniture advertising, infrastructure free framework, hospitality initiatives, special events hosting and destination attractions, nominal leasing policy, van sports, and MST business partnership. So MST is the indigenous corporation, that development corporation. So it seems to me that pretty much each of these nine items, either they're vague, like hospitality initiative, what is street furniture advertising? I don't know, but they're all commercialization. They're all privatization. They're all some sort of, you know, alliance with private corporations, sponsorship and naming rights. So naming rights, again, it's a way of moving the public sector into the private sector. So rather than having a park with the name of some historical figure or the person that founded the park or a mayor or whatever, the idea is to now name it after a private corporation who then pays money for it. So this is the approach that the current municipal government in Vancouver, and the Vancouver Park Board, this is the approach that they're taking.
The street furniture advertising, or whatever they want to phrase it, and the, you know, the sponsorship orientation, all that kind of stuff, is again this sort of shifting of mediums to like, or making, I should say, making media mediums out of you know, public space at public areas, right? So as you kind of said, like I suppose that the street furniture advertising is basically saying that park benches are, you know, no longer are going to now be covered in ads and stuff like that, right? Like I suppose it's probably things like that, or you know tennis courts are going to have ads on the walls now or whatever. And this is a shift to like normalizing again everything into being a kind of profit value driven model, where like literally now, like even where you sit has to be an ad. Every space, every optional space has to be an advertisement, or has to be a sponsorship, or has to be associated with some sort of company or some sort of influential group or whatever, right? There's no longer just, you know, the kind of free communal park space, you know, this realm of communal discourse and activity, it's now just a space for advertising effectively, right? Or corporate ownership or involvement or whatever, right? Again, this is the kind of the corporatocracy thing where it's just like everything, like big business has its, you know, claws in everything that, you know, is happening, and everything that used to be public is now at least tinged or controlled or manipulated by some sort of business interest.
So corporatocracy really suggests that this merging of the private and the public, where the public starts to look more like the private and it's run more like the private through corporatism and through privatization. So whereas in maybe the way things used to be, or maybe the way we wish things would become again, there is a space of peace and quiet that people can enjoy in the public sector where they're free from the bombardment with advertisement and commercialization and from being treated like a consumer, right? So in the private sector, we turn on the television and we get bombarded with advertisements because what we are, we're consumers and they want our money. So do we really want to have all of our lives? Do we want to have no place to go? Do we want to have no place to seek refuge from that? And according to the principles of corporatism, corporatocracy, privatization, the public sector, the public sphere, our public resources will get invaded by that same bombardment. We will be nothing more than consumers, and our public facilities, our public institutions will be run like corporations. And which is, as I gave with the example with the park board, it's a different purpose for it's a different goal, right? So the goal of the city bureaucrats might be efficiency, but the goal of an elected board like the Vancouver Park Board ought to be governance, and governance in a way that's to the benefit of the people. And it might not always coincide with corporate efficiency.
It's all just consumers, right? That's the kind of main sort of gist, I think, of the ideology behind a lot of these people. And I know in some previous episodes, we've even kind of looked at, you know, some of the, you know, kind of more modern thinkers or influential business people or whatever it might be in some of their own writings, where they more or less lay this out, right? That, like, you know, society should be a business. It's all about efficiency, and citizenry is really just, you know, the position of a consumer within, like, the wider system. And, you know, there's also all sorts of other tricks and stuff going on there. I mean, we already talked about media a little bit, but, you know, one of the biggest things that I think media, like mass media does, one of the biggest tricks that it plays is this idea that media is neutral, right? That, like, whatever media you're listening to or news outlet is a neutral, unbiased source, and they're giving you the cold, hard facts.
I think you're absolutely right to say that the sort of almost like the category of the citizen is sort of being erased by and being replaced by this dichotomy of like consumer and producer. But I mean, producer and consumers of particular content, right? Of things to be served. But there's a sort of adage that I've always, I mean, it's a kind of a popular adage, but it's always sort of evoked when things like trial versions or, you know, free trials, or like you can have it for free, but it comes with advertisements on like a particular app or something, come up. And it's that if it's free, you're the product, right? And it turns the spaces within which the advertisements are being placed into a place where you become a product, right? It pushes out your capacity to be a citizen or just a person in that space into, okay, well, how good are our ads doing in this particular space, right? That's another sort of encroachment of corporate interests into public spaces, is they're no longer seen as communal spaces. They're no longer seen as having an inherent right to exist in their own right. Those, that complete category of its own existence is subsumed by its instrumentality for corporate interest and turning the people that occupy those spaces into the product.
I think, again, a really great example of that, where, you know, the consumer really is the product, is media and news media primarily, right? Like certain news media outlets, like, for example, to be specific, in the United States, there's five corporations. They've got them listed down here. Actually, it's Disney, Comcast, Paramount, Warner Brothers, and Fox own the vast majority of all news media produced within the United States. This is within the USA. And each sort of section has their own sort of demographic, right? And they sort of tailor their news interest to their specific demographic, and that specific demographic gets used to that kind of news cycle, that particular flavor that they're particularly always punching out, and then they always are kind of seeking more of that flavor, right? And so in a sense, the consumer of that news also becomes the product of that news, because they're, you know, they're tinged by the news cycle itself, so that their kind of worldview is changed in a particular way by the news media, the news that they're being fed. But then also, too, they're being effectively habituated to want more of the same kind of news, right? Like, if you're a diehard Fox person, you're not suddenly going to jump over to CNN or MSNBC or whatever, right? Even though when it comes down to it, like, the actual owners of all these companies more than likely all hang out together, you know, like, you know, they all have each other on speed dial. But you would never know from the actual, you know, resulted products and different sort of, you know, echo chambers and groups that are created. And there's also the way in which they influence news media to have a, you know, to again value particular things. So one thing that becomes always a value is efficiency and success in terms of wealth accumulation, all that kind of stuff. But then there's also, too, the trivialization and the diminishment of older values and, you know, more kind of cherished principles, or whatever you want to call it. I'm thinking particularly about, you know, I was reading recently about, if listeners remember the stuff around Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, two kind of whistleblowers, you know, from behind WikiLeaks, and Edward Snowden did the dump from the NSA, where basically it was turned out the U.S. government was spying on large portions of the population. But the more important point to this is that what the news media did during the cycle, instead of focusing on the, you know, pretty important revelations that these people released, they tried to trivialize these sorts of things. So, for example, they turned Edward Snowden, the focus became less of, oh, what did he release? What is the NSA doing? And more into, is Edward Snowden a criminal? Right? Let's focus the news media on this. Is he a criminal? Is he a hero? And some news channels were worshiping him, and some news channels were vilifying him. But the point on both ends is, again, this corporatocracy hand in hand with the government kind of ignoring what he actually released, the reasons that, you know, his name is even in the news. Or, for example, Julian Assange, the whole thing became more about how he's locked in a embassy for years and lives in a bathroom, and he's hiding out in this embassy. And again, never mind WikiLeaks, never mind all the stuff that these governments and all the stuff that he's kind of revealed that they're doing. That's not important. Let's focus on the fact that there's this kind of fun, crazy, weird story that there's this dude hiding out in an embassy, right? Again, it's trivializing these things, even though what both of those individuals did was try to bring to light really important and disturbing encroachments on, you know, the public sphere and individual citizenry and rights and all that kind of stuff, right? But news media on either side kind of had no interest in focusing on that kind of stuff, obviously, because they're linked hand in hands with, you know, government and individuals in power, and instead try to trivialize that stuff and turn them into caricatures or whatever it want to be, right?
I'm looking at an article from CBC Vancouver, from their Metro Matters show, and it's entitled How the Privatization Debate Will Soon Come to Vancouver City Hall. So this is about a little over two years old, the article. But it says, could Vancouverites soon be crossing the London Drugs Burrard Street Bridge to get to a privately managed Vancouver Aquatic Center? That or something similar to it is the a reality the city could soon be considering. City Councilor Brian Montague is quoted as saying, I don't know why people would be opposed to public-private partnerships. Clearly, we wouldn't want to do that in every case, but I think there are some examples that might be a solution because we can't keep getting into the pockets of Vancouver taxpayers. That's exactly what has been happening in Vancouver is the taxpayers, especially the property owners, have been treated with kid gloves, whereas common citizens, the people who are of lower income, which are the bulk of Vancouverites, who can't even afford a property in the first place, they're getting hit with higher fees.
I don't want to, like, I think some people would say this is a slippery slope, but, or a slippery slope fallacy, but, you know, Ryan Montague even kind of brings up there this idea that it's like, who would be opposed to public-private partnerships? Obviously, this is good sometimes, but not all the time. But here's the thing. Business is always seeking to expand. It's always seeking to grow. It's always seeking to increase profit margins and shareholder value and all that kind of stuff, right? From the bottom all the way to the top. And so obviously, these things are always going to want to expand, right? Like we've talked about on the show before how, you know, if you leave a space open within the, you know, democratic and economic sphere, some sort of private interest will fill that space, right? So if you give them the opportunity, they will go there. So this idea that it's like, oh, well, we're just going to do it a little bit, right? We just want a little bit of private, in, you know, more private business involvement. We just want a little bit more corporate involvement, but we're not going to go all the way. But it's like, look, those corporations are more than interested with taking it all the way. If you let them do that, they will. They don't have brakes. This idea that somehow like big business is always going to put brakes on itself. Like, what was the 2008 financial crisis, right? That was, you know, decades of big business and, you know, large corporate interests doing all sorts of completely whacked out and unsustainable policies for their own interests until it completely collapsed on itself. And then they just did it all over again, right? Like, they're not interested in, you know, preserving the public good. That's why we have democratically elected bodies. That's why we have public representation, whether it's at the federal level or something like the Municipal Park Board in Vancouver, right? Like, they're there to protect public interests because business is not going to do that. That's not their prerogative.
There's actually another concept which ties in with the three we've discussed, which is centralization. So that's part of the this model that goes along with the transfer of resources of wealth from the and control from the public to the private sector, the marriage between corporations and government acting like a corporation. So centralization. I'm reading from an article also a few years old from the Mainlander magazine written by Nathan Crompton. And he writes in part, he says, some critics of Sim, that's Mayor Sim, who at one time was campaigning to actually abolish the park board. Sim is ran up against a brick wall where the David Eby, the at the provincial level, wouldn't do it, had to come from the provincial level because it's provincial legislation that created the park board. So now Sim's backing down, and now there's an election coming up in October, and Sim is not very popular for his campaign to abolish the park board. So he's backing down and he's saying, well, no, I'm not going to do it. Instead, he's running ABC, his party's running candidates for park board commissioner. But as far as his move to trying to abolish the park board a couple of years ago, it's written here in the article that some critics of Sim have lamented the undemocratic nature of the move and have framed the park board as being closer to people because of its smaller scale. There is a clear and discernible trend towards centralization in the hands of the mayor's office and arguably to an even greater degree, the unelected city manager's office. Both the Vancouver Economic Commission and the city's housing file have recently been folded directly into the city manager's office, reporting to the mayor. This partly explains the $180,000 additional budget added to Sims' office in the recent municipal budget. Regarding the centralization of parks and recreation decisions, Sims stated, when you have more than one person accountable for anything, no one is accountable. So centralization sounds a lot like a move toward dictatorship where one person or a smaller group of people makes the decisions rather than maybe a larger elected body. And so I can't go into detail right now with the time, but I can tell you that since Mayor Sim failed to get the park board completely dissolved, he's found ways of sort of working around the park board. And in fact, there was a Supreme Court of British Columbia decision about a year ago, which I'm familiar with, which declared that the city of Vancouver, the bureaucratic side, right, the bureaucrats, not the elected officials of the park board, was making decisions and entering into large contracts without proper authorization. They were bypassing the park board. And that's true with respect to the multi-million dollar logging contract that the city of Vancouver signed with the contractor. And it's a whole other matter we can't get into, but the city claimed that there was a big danger of wildfire and trees falling on people because there was a lot of dead or dying trees in Stanley Park. And so the city went ahead and contracted for upwards of $4 million. Now it's gone up to about, I think, $20 million over the last few years. But the initial contract with the contractor was supposed to be approved by the park board commissioners, but the city went around the park board commissioners and signed the contract anyway. So if we can say that the city bureaucrats are probably working under the auspices of the city government, which is run by Mayor Sim, then it seems like the municipal government has been trying to consolidate power and work around the elected officials. So it seems that's an example of centralization.
Yeah, and I think the centralization of power argument can be linked to the wider phenomena of oligarchy that we're seeing kind of around the globe within the context of big business and democracy. And what I mean by that is, you know, earlier we talked about efficiency. Well, if you kind of centralize, you know, power as much as possible within the context of whatever government bodies you're going to have, you know, removing more elected officials and all that kind of stuff, you make it easier for the marriage between big business and government that is corporatocracy, right? Because now big business only has to influence and talk to and, you know, kind of go through a select number of government officials and people who they have relationships with, who they've bought off or whatever, right? If you get rid of all these sort of, you know, checks and balances in the process of any kind of democracy and quote unquote centralize, well, then you make it a whole lot easier to transfer and influence power within the context of any sort of local or larger government.
I gave the example before of the split in the Vancouver Park Board about a year ago, where some of the commissioners, and they actually prevailed, wanted to increase the delegated authority to the city for the city to enter into large purchases, right, to make large procurements, enter into logging contracts and other types of contracts without the seven elected commissioners approving. But there was a few who were in the minority of the commissioners who protested and said, no, the purpose of the park board is to govern. In order to do that, we need to keep oversight. We need to retain our oversight. Whereas the city might want to enter into contracts for efficiency, or maybe a more cynical approach or a skeptical approach would be to say maybe they want to do it because of their alliance with big business, with private companies, and they all benefit by the private companies getting big contracts. So, but that's not in the interest of governance, right? That's not the interest of the people or the what the park board is supposed to be doing. And power is being taken away from the people. It's anti-democratic. And the commissioners who might scrutinize contracts before they give permission to sign them, they're in the way, as you were saying, Hale. They're in the way because the corporatocracy, that this alliance between the government, the city bureaucrats, and the private companies wants to be able to function efficiently without having to go to elected officials, such as the park board commissioners, who might be asking questions about, do we really need this contract, or can we find, you know, a less expensive way of doing it? Do we really need to remove 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 trees from Stanley Park? Is there, what's the justification for that? So those people who are asking those questions get in the way. They get in the way of the corporatocracy.
And frankly, like, efficiency to do what? Precisely the things that they want to do, right? Which is to, like, the activities that the board is there explicitly to, you know, moderate on and make those checks and balance decisions for, which apparently is they're being stopped by the board.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, Brandon.
They're looking for another way around it.
There, it's sort of like, you know, the corporatocracy, this sort of marriage between particular elements of government and, you know, big business and international, you know, conglomeration or whatever you want to call it. You know, they see it, public power in most cases as a hindrance to their interests. So exactly as you say, instead of, they're like, oh, for example, the Parks Board is problematic. It's getting in the way of what we want to do, which is, you know, make money and extract value or whatever. Get rid of the Parks Board, right? Like, get rid of that. Get move that out of the way. That's a problem, right? And that just goes to show, like, where their principles lie, right? Like, they're not interested in preserving citizenry. They're not interested in preserving public discourse. They're not interested in democracy. They're not interested in public welfare. They're interested in their own interests, for lack of a better way of saying it, right? Their own primarily financial interest, shareholder value, whatever it's going to be. And so anything that gets in the way of that is going to, you know, kind of is a problem that needs to be solved for them, right? Even if it's something that benefits the wider community, benefits the average citizen. As we kind of said earlier, like, big business is never going to be on the side of the little guy, right? That's just not how they operate, right? Like, that's just not, like, good for shareholder value. That's not their prerogative. That's not their modus operandi. So they're going to look for ways to get around that, whatever that might be.
Thank you very much, Hale and Brandon. I'm Michael Robert Kaditz. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. The support from our awesome community helps keeping the station diverse and independent. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Nothing says summer like a day at the beach. Whether you're lounging by a lake or enjoying a seaside vacation, here are five things you can do to share the shore with birds. 1. Give birds their space. Keep a respectful distance, especially if there are chicks present. 2. Read posted signs and don't enter areas that have been fenced off to protect breeding birds. Some beaches have shorebird monitoring volunteers who can share more information about how to safely access the shoreline. 3. Keep your pets on leash. Even the best trained dogs can harass and hurt birds if left unsupervised. 4. Watch your step. Shorebird eggs and chicks are highly camouflaged and often blend into the beach. Try sticking close to the water, since beach nesting birds are more likely to lay eggs on higher ground where they won't wash away with the tide. 5. Pick up trash. Billions of pounds of plastic enter our global oceans every year, with deadly consequences for marine animals. And leftover food attracts predators, like gulls and raccoons, that may prey on vulnerable shorebirds. Learn more about the difference you can make for birds when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin. This episode is brought to you by Jim and Birta Falconer of Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.